This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 7th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ward. The Oregon State Legislature will hold a hearing tomorrow on a bill that could result in the reinstatement of Portland's controversial sit-lie ordinance. The city of Portland had previously criminalized sitting or lying down on public sidewalks, but the state legislature overturned that ban in 2011. But a new bill promoted by Portland's representatives in the state legislature would allow the city of Portland to reinstate the ban. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
A new law has just been introduced to the Oregon legislature that could possibly revive a struck-down 2009 law that prohibited the homeless from sitting on public sidewalks. House Bill 2963 would allow municipalities to write laws that would prohibit the homeless from sitting or lying on sidewalks in the city of Portland. It was sponsored by the House Judiciary Committee and is supported by Clean and Safe District, a program of the Portland Business Alliance. Violators of the proposed bill could face a fine of up to $250. The bill has an emergency clause, or E-clause, meaning that unlike other legislation that becomes effective at the start of the new calendar year, this bill, if it becomes law, will be enacted as soon as it is signed by the governor. Unlike other recent laws that have been written around state preeminence, such as Multnomah County's recent gun legislation, this law gives the municipality the ability to preempt state law. That means that even if the state has a rule in the books that allows the homeless to occupy a sidewalk, the city may enforce its own law. It is unusual for a state legislature to give such preemption ability to a municipality. ORS 166.170 says that except as expressly authorized by a state, no county or city or other municipal corporation may enact such ordinances. Although local businesses support the law because they say it will reduce aggressive panhandling and shoplifting, Monica Garacki at the Oregon Law Center, a homeless advocate, says the stricter sidewalk rules won't end shoplifting or aggressive panhandling. A number of local homeless advocacy organizations, to include Street Roots and Transition Projects, have expressed concern over the controversial laws, which were struck down as unconstitutional by an Oregon Circuit Court in 2009. Heather Dorfman is with Sisters of the Road.
You know, Sisters of the Road affirms that Portland streets are for everyone who lives in the city, not just for Portland Business Alliance constituents. And unfortunately, this is a national trend that's happening all across the country. Business improvement districts use public dollars to try to pass laws that criminalize poor and homeless people. And we believe that instead we need to provide concrete long-term solutions with houses and jobs to people.
Does Portland have a repository of services that the homeless can access, such as food, clothing, showers, things like that?
You know, there are some services absolutely out there, a lot of folks doing a lot of great work, and it's not nearly enough for the number of people that are homeless in our city. And people need a place to go. And so if folks don't have any other place to go, they're going to have to sit down or lie down where they can. And these are public streets, and people need to be able to get off their feet, sit down, take a rest. People aren't able to just keep going and walking all day long, and they can't always get into services.
The Portland homeless problem, has it been getting worse, getting better over the last few years?
I think the economy has absolutely impacted a lot of folks, and we're seeing a lot of people who are now homeless who have never been homeless before. And it's for all of these reasons that we really believe it's imperative that we pass an Oregon Homeless Bill of Rights to stand up for poor people's human rights, because we really believe the ability to be in public spaces is a human right.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
A Portland company recently created a website that allows the public to view a map of surveillance cameras in Oregon. The site, titled Community Cam, reports around 2,000 cameras in the state. The website's founder, Josh Daniels, says that Community Cam can be used for the common good. He claims that it will help citizens find cameras that could have captured footage of a theft or break-in. The website allows viewers to see where cameras are located, but does not give access to the video feed. Obtaining video files from the cameras might not be so easy. TMT Development, a Portland-based property management company, says they would turn down any request to access unless it comes from the court. The website draws attention to growing concern around privacy violations with regards to surveillance cameras. Some even argue that the cameras could lead to virtual stalking. In a recent poll conducted by CBS News and the New York Times, support for constant video monitoring is gaining popularity. The poll shows that the majority of Americans are okay with being recorded by surveillance cameras in public. But civil liberties groups point out that this may be a reaction to the Boston bombing, adding that most Americans value their privacy and don't see the need for constant surveillance.
Today, Portland Mayor Charlie Hale's office announced that some people who have already paid the citywide $35 arts tax are eligible for a refund. The tax was approved by Portland voters on last November's ballot to support arts programs in public schools. An earlier analysis of the tax revealed that, in a household that was, on the whole, over the poverty level, individuals who have no actual income were still expected to pay the tax. It was then revised to apply only to people over earning $1,000 annually. The current problem with the tax is that people have paid whose only income comes from welfare or the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS, and the city is not able to levy taxes on either source of income. Anybody who receives their income through welfare or PERS may be eligible for a refund when the city works out the problem.
On Monday, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber signed a bill that cuts pension benefits for some retired public employees. The bill limits inflation increases for employees earning more than $20,000 a year in pension benefits, angering many public workers. Republicans also opposed the bill, saying it doesn't make deep enough cuts. Governor Kitzhaber himself was unhappy with the extent of the bill, saying that he too thinks deeper cuts are necessary, but he signed the bill anyway as a first step in order to free up funds for education. Public employees claim that the bill violates their contract with the state.
For years, sea lions have been blamed for the drop in salmon population along the Columbia River. Many environmental groups have pointed out that a number of other factors are to blame, including other predators, introduced fish species, poor fish hatchery practices, and especially the dams themselves. Despite these claims, sea lions have been steadily branded for death and killed by fishermen around the Bonneville Dam for years, based on government recommendations. For more on the story and increasing outcry against the practices, KABU spoke with Don Groth of the group Worldwide Events Ending Animal Cruelty, or WEAC.
What exactly is happening at the dams with the sea lions?
Basically, the salmon stocks have decreased. They've actually put them on an endangered species list, but they're allowing the fishermen to fish them anyway. But what they're doing is they're blaming the sea lions, who eat, you know, a handful in comparison to what these dams actually kill. So what they're doing is they're branding the sea lions, and that marks them for death. And then they kill them, if of course the sea lions survive the branding.
And is this by law that it's happening, or is it the fishermen
Yes.
taking it on themselves?
No, it's definitely by law. Okay, these dams are basically moneymakers for the government. So rather than consider, you know, removing them, which they're old and unnecessary, they prefer to put the blame on the sea lions. Apparently, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has even said that the hydroelectric dams kill the majority of the salmon. And the government knows this, but they refuse to, of course, remove their money source.
What efforts are underway to protest this or change it, and what sort of reaction have they gotten?
The Humane Society of the United States takes them to court every year, and apparently the court upholds the government's desire to kill the sea lions rather than look at the real cause, which is dams. If they took down these dams, the problem would go away. There's a lot of petitions out there. Right now, there are a handful of activists at the Bonneville Dam, and they monitor and photograph and videotape everything that's happening there. The locals and the fishermen basically bully those people. I don't know if the locals and the fishermen even realize, you know, they may know that the dams are the cause, and their hands are tied based on what the government's saying. So they're going to do whatever they can, I suppose, to be able to catch their fish. so what I wanted to do is try and get as many people on the ground over there protesting this. They may be able to bully a handful of people, but they aren't going to be able to bully a mass amount of people. And I want attention on this situation so that they can do something about this. Let's stop keeping it covered under the rug. The media never talks about it. It's been going on for years. I want people to be aware, and I want to try and get a protest going up there. I'm shooting for the 11th, but if we can't get people, we'll change the date.
Do you have any place where people could find you?
Our website is weeac.com.
Okay, and that's weeac.com. For KABU Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Dawn Groth of the group Worldwide Events Ending Animal Cruelty.
A new study has found that the Keystone XL pipeline could cost billions of dollars in health and environmental damages. The study, released today by the environmental advocacy group Oil Change International, warns that the pipeline's climate pollution could cause $100 billion a year in health, property, agriculture, and ecosystem damage. The study was released on the heels of the EPA asking the State Department for detailed information related to the social costs of the Keystone XL pipeline. For more, KABU's Rebecca Ney spoke with Lauren Stockman, the research director from Oil Change International.
Lauren, how did you guys come up with this $100 billion annual figure?
Well, it's a calculation we've made based on something called the social cost of carbon. It's really a developing analysis that's being carried out by a number of government agencies within the U.S. government, as well as academics and economists and other international agencies like the International Monetary Fund. And they've been looking at the cost climate change is imposing on health, on infrastructure, on security and other issues around the world, and trying to put a figure on how much a ton of carbon dioxide costs society in terms of climate change impacts. So we actually did a report a few weeks ago where we estimated the total annual greenhouse gases of the Keystone that would be emitted by the Keystone XL pipeline. And then we looked at a range of figures for the social cost of carbon. And the $100 billion figure is pretty close to the top of the range of figures.
Can you break down for our listeners how the Keystone XL pipeline is going to have an impact on climate change?
Well, the Keystone XL pipeline will bring over 800,000 barrels per day of some of the most carbon-intensive oil that is being extracted on the planet today. So that oil is being dug up in Alberta, Canada. The process to extract it requires more energy and therefore releases more greenhouse gases that cause climate change upstream in Alberta. It then will be piped to the Texas Gulf Coast, where the refineries that will process it will also use a lot of energy to process that bitumen. Is in fact bitumen, not oil, a sort of semi-solid form of oil. The emissions from the refineries, then of course we have the products that are produced from the bitumen, gasoline, diesel, other byproducts such as petroleum coke. These products go out into the market and they are consumed and emit greenhouse gases. So the addition of this piece of infrastructure that isn't there today carries with it a burden of greenhouse gases that will contribute to global climate change.
Was your study sent to the EPA, and what kind of a response are you expecting from them?
We will send the study to the EPA. In terms of what kind of response, we expect them to be supportive of the State Department doing more to analyze these costs on society of the pipeline and to consider them in the impact assessment of the pipeline, which the current draft environmental impact assessment does not do. Well, hopefully EPA will support our call to the State Department to investigate these costs and consider these costs when assessing the impact of the pipeline.
I've been speaking with Lauren Stockman, the research director from Oil Change International, who just released a study warning that the Keystone XL pipeline could cost up to $100 billion per year in health and environmental damages. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's show tells a story of Q Center's Volunteer of the Year, who was dismissed from her duties after failing a background check. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast is cloudy in the morning with a gradual clearing and a high near 76.
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Amy Meyer was curious, then she was appalled. Then she was charged with the crime of using a cell phone to video what appalled her. Welcome to the brave new world of ag-gag laws being pushed by agribusiness corporations to stop reporters, workers, animal rights advocates, and even curious 25-year-old truth seekers like Miss Meyer from recording abuses that are routinely taking place on farm animal confinement factories. Actually, these are the repressive laws of the cowardly new world of industrial ag biz, eager to keep its customers in the dark about what they're doing to the pigs, cows, chickens, etc. under their care. A resident of Utah, which passed its gag law last year, Meyer heard about some ugly doings at the Smith & Sons meat packing outfit in the town of Draper City, so she decided to take a look. Even from the public roadway where she stood, the horror was easy to see, and she dared to document it with her camera. The corporate manager scrambled out to declare that she was trespassing, later claiming that she had crossed a barbed wire fence onto corporate property. Cops were called, no such trespass was found, and she was released. But the corporation, whose owner just happens to be mayor of Draper, got city prosecutors to charge her with, ready? Agricultural operation interference, punishable by a 6-month jail term. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, thanks to a web alert by Will Potter, author of a blog named GreenIsTheNewRed.com, global public outrage poured into Draper City, and in just 24 hours, prosecutors dropped all charges against Meyer, the first person in America to be charged under these ridiculous laws. Thanks to stand-up rebels like Amy, Will, and thousands of freedom defenders, AgBiz is choking on its own ag-gag scam. To help fight it, go to change.org/aggag.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
As the Guantanamo hunger strike continues, with more than 1,000 prisoners participating, the publicity around the strike has shed light on the practice of force feeding, which is actually common in U.S. prisons. One Connecticut inmate, William Coleman, has been force-fed over 5 years. for over 5 years. Coleman has lost half his body weight and four teeth, but has continued his hunger strike to protest what he says was an unjust conviction. Prisoners in Washington, Utah, Illinois, and Wisconsin have all recently gone to court to challenge their force-feeding by prison medical staff. In all of those cases, the court allowed the force-feedings to continue. The practice of force-feeding is considered torture under international law and is universally condemned by the United Nations and human rights groups. But the U.S. government has repeatedly authorized force-feeding of inmates, and in a press conference last week, President Obama confirmed that the force-feeding of prisoners at Guantanamo will continue. Although he called on Congress to authorize the closing of Guantanamo, he said that his first priority is to keep the prisoners from dying. But prisoners on hunger strike say that this violates their rights, and international statutes confirm that force-feeding is a violation of prisoner rights and a direct violation of international law. Prisoners engage in hunger strikes to protest their conditions and to call for their release. Starving themselves is often the only option they have, since their other rights have already been stripped away.
A 73-year-old lawyer imprisoned in Texas has called on the Bureau of Prisons to release her from her sentence, since she is dying of cancer. Lynn Stewart was imprisoned for issuing a press release on behalf of one of her clients. Now Stewart's family is pleading with the state for compassionate release. Numerous international human rights campaigners, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have signed a petition calling for her to be freed on medical grounds. Ralph Schoenman with the Campaign to Free Lynn Stewart spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia.
Well, the developments are moving very quickly with regard to Lynn Stewart. The international campaign has reached a new threshold of almost 15,000 signatories, and every day prominent people from around the world are making declarations in support of Lynn. One of the consequences of this is that the warden at the Bureau of Prisons has actually finally found himself compelled to grant Lynn Stewart compassionate release. The warden at FMC Carswell has recommended compassionate release for Lynn Stewart and has forwarded that recommendation to the director of the Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels. The significance of that is that the finder of fact with regard to the circumstances of Lynn is the warden, and consequently the warden and his physicians have been compelled by not just the campaign but the exigent circumstances of Lynn, who not only has stage 4 cancer and lung cancer, but now her white cell count is down, so she's a grave risk for infection and she's been put in quarantine. So under these circumstances and the enormous growth of the campaign, the warden has actually recommended compassionate release and referred that to the director of the Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels. And the day before yesterday, the house where Lynn will be staying, namely of her son, Jeffrey Stewart, the lawyer, was inspected for approval and approved, which is a rather advanced stage and indicative of the fact that the Bureau of Prisons is going to recommend compassionate release to Judge John Codal, who was the sentencing judge. So we've reached a new threshold in this effort, and it's measured by the fact that Associated Press did a major story on Lynn, which has been published in every newspaper, major newspaper in the United States, either online or in print, from New York Times and Washington Post to the Wall Street Journal, and from Wyoming to Louisiana. And yesterday, the New York Times, in its editorial, actually took up the cry of our campaign and that of Human Rights Watch in a lead editorial called "In Place of Compassion, Cruelty," and a savagely excoriating indictment of the Federal Bureau of Prisons for its failure to implement the Compassionate Release Program.
That was Ralph Schoenman with the Campaign to Free Lynn Stewart.
In a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee today, Chairman Carl Levin expressed concern about the Defense Department's apparent inability to address sexual assault in the military. Today's hearing followed the arrest on Sunday of Air Force Officer Jeffrey Krasinski for sexual assault. The 41-year-old lieutenant led the service's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Unit. Krasinski was released the same day on a $5,000 bail. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel called for a plan to increase the accountability of military personnel who commit sexual assault. A new Pentagon report estimates that over 70 sexual assaults involve military personnel every day. Another recent Pentagon report found that the number of sexual assaults involving service members rose from 19,000 in 2011 to 26,000 this year.
An editor for an Iranian news website has been arrested for reporting evidence of voter fraud. The reporter claimed to have heard an audio file of President Ahmadinejad discussing tampering with the votes into the 2009 election. The president and his office have rejected this claim. So far, the audio tape has not surfaced. Ahmadinejad's supporters claim that this report is an attempt to undermine his attempts to choose a successor in the upcoming election.
Syrian rebel groups seized four unarmed UN peacekeepers on patrol in the Golan Heights today. The group calls themselves the Yarmouk Martyrs Brigade. They released a photo on their Facebook page this morning showing that the four captives remain unharmed. For the last 4 years, UN peacekeepers have patrolled the Golan Heights in order to maintain the armistice signed by Israel and Syria. In recent months, tension has heightened as violence from the war in Syria spills over into the region. In March of this year, the Yarmouk Martyrs Brigade held 21 Filipino peacekeepers for 4 days before releasing them unharmed. Today's abduction has also heightened the tension between Israel and Syria. Israel has not yet officially claimed responsibility for airstrikes on Syria's capital, Damascus, this past weekend, but some Israeli officials have admitted that Israeli forces carried out the airstrikes, allegedly aimed at destroying weapons that Israel claims were headed to Hezbollah. Analyst Reese Ehrlich spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia about the U.S. threat of military involvement in Syria.
I think the key thing to focus on is that it has nothing to do with whether there really are chemical weapons being used or whether Syria is shipping arms to Hezbollah, which the Israelis have struck. What you have to focus on is the United States preparing for a military attack on Syria under the guise of a selective bombing or a no-fly zone, something like that? If the answer is yes, then suddenly all kinds of information will surface that they're using chemical weapons. If no, then there will be continued doubts. That's the why the language is as confusing as it is, because it reflects a very big debate in Washington about whether to militarily attack Syria. You know, the doctrine of humanitarian assistance is the latest excuse that those in power in Washington use for intervention. When Republicans are in power, they openly talk about, you know, expanding U.S. business and military influence. Everyone talks about oil, etc. When the Democrats in power, they talk about humanitarian aid. But the reality is, for the people on the ground in Syria, they're going to get bombed by, you know, it makes no difference what the excuse is. And same for Libya and same for Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. It's simply the latest in a long line of legal excuses that was never intended to justify imperial intervention.
That was author and analyst Reese Ehrlich speaking on the potential for U.S. involvement in Syria.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, May 7th, 2013. Israeli man attack a Palestinian taxi driver in Jerusalem and Israeli settlers attack Palestinian farmers in northern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli police spokesperson Luba Sumari reported that an Israeli man stabbed a Palestinian taxi driver south of Jerusalem and added that initial investigation indicate that the motive of the attack is a dispute over the fare. Sumari said that the assailant remains at large as he fled the scene after stabbing the driver. She added that the injured taxi driver was moved to an Israeli hospital in the city, suffering moderate injuries. Also on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers stationed at the entrance of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem attacked several Palestinian youth and prevented them from entering the mosque. Local sources reported that the army kidnapped one resident identified as Jamal al-Balbisi and added that a Palestinian woman was injured and was moved to a local hospital after being attacked by the soldiers. Eyewitnesses reported that nearly 50 settlers and members of the Likud party of Benjamin Netanyahu marched into the mosque while the police attacked several worshippers while trying to push them away from the mosque area. In other news, a group of extremist Israeli settlers burned late on Monday night 20 dunams of Palestinian agricultural land that belongs to residents of Burin village, south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Ghassan Douglas, in charge of settlements file at the Palestinian Authority in the northern part of the West Bank, reported that settlers burned dozens of trees and hurled stones at Palestinian cars south of Nablus. Douglas added that the settlers forced two Palestinian cars to stop and attack the passengers who ran away fearing for their lives. The settlers then destroyed the two cars and left the scene. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, May 7th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan and Pakistani forces exchanged fire along a disputed border on Monday. This is the second clash of its kind in less than a week. Both sides used artillery and mortar rounds in the 2 hours of fighting near the Ghoshta area of the eastern Afghan province of Nangarhar. The NATO-led international force brokered a temporary ceasefire. Names were released today of 10 soldiers killed late last week in two separate attacks in Afghanistan. Five Army soldiers, two from the Marines and three from the Air Force, were killed by improvised explosive devices. One of the soldiers killed in the attacks was a 24-year-old from Bend, Oregon, who enlisted in Portland in 2010 and was deployed to Afghanistan after finishing basic training in Texas.